Welcome to Identity, a series brought to you by ID Magazine. Join me, Osman Ahmed, ID's Fashion Features Director, as I explore the enduring legacy of some of the last four decades' most influential subcultures and the guiding figures within them. This season, we're taking a different tack, with each episode focusing on an artist whose life and work are anchored in subculture. Today, I'm joined by one of my favourite fashion designers, Martine Rose. Martine is a rare example of someone who has both commercial success and critical acclaim. A designer's designer, as it were, known around the world to both fashion fanatics and subculture boffs.
I remember suddenly seeing this mix of people, like it was sort of ex-football hooligans with rosters, with crusties, with rude boys. A shift had happened. Football hooliganism literally died overnight because ecstasy and drug culture and dance culture came in. And I knew instinctively, even at that young age, that something important was happening. Once I was making my own choices about music, it was dance music because it was really club culture that was exciting. I think it sort of reinforced my love of outsiders, you know, outsiders and characters and complicated geniuses. I was building this confidence up. I was starting to believe that maybe my view on fashion is relevant.
Her work riffs on contemporary everyday clothes, often containing nods to her encyclopedic knowledge of British subcultures. From acid house heads to 90s junglists, football hooligans, gabba ravers to the rude boys of the reggae scene. In the way they're custom formed, Martine's clothes read as clothing that has already been worn in, familiar but twisted, sometimes too big or too small, always with something a bit off. Her casting has always been radically inclusive, long before it was fashionable, and often her fashion shows are held in unusual locations. A primary school in Kentish Town, a climbing centre in Tottenham, a former gay sauna in Vauxhall, or a Latin food market in Seven Sisters, almost always as a love letter to London. She grew up in her grandparents' house in South London, which was the centre of the local Jamaican community, full of music. Her upbringing set her on the path to a lifelong exploration of British nightlife, music and subculture, eventually becoming a part of her work as a fashion designer after she graduated from Middlesex University in 2002 and set up her namesake label in 2007. But it hasn't always been easy as a creative person surviving in London. By 2015, Martine faced homelessness after being kicked out of the squat she was living in with her partner and baby. That same year, she got a job that would prove to be life-changing. Balenciaga's Demna asked her to be a menswear consultant for the fashion house, and for the next 3 years, she helped perfect the enlarged silhouette at Balenciaga that caught on everywhere, from the catwalk to the high street. Now, through her collaborations with Nike and Clarks, Martine has a global audience, as well as plenty of awards and accolades, all the while remaining respected within her local community of outsiders. She is a designer who does things her own way, often refusing to comply with the system. So without further ado, here she is, Martine Rose. Well, thanks, Martine, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Well, let's go back to the beginning. I wanted to talk to you about your early life. You were born in Bristol, partly grew up in Croydon, but also a lot in South London, in Tooting.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about what your family life was like and what kind of music and the people and who they were, who you were exposed to at a young age.
So my early life was really, I don't know, warm is sort of the closest thing I can think of to describe it, because it centred around my nan and granddad's house, which was the sort of the centre of my universe and the centre of our family's universe, I guess. And it was a big extended family. It was a very outward looking house, so it had a completely open door policy. The doorbell was ringing 24 hours a day with various people coming. It was sort of the centre of the, you know, or one of those houses that was sort of the centre of the black community, I guess, a bit at the time. It was just a house full of energy. It was multi-generational. So I had lots of cousins around my own age and older. You know, there were people of my grandparents' age, but then lots of people of my aunties and uncles' age. So it was very intergenerational, very interactive. And it was a house that was full of music.
Yeah. And talk to me about the music. What were some of the records that you remember from really early on that kind of stayed with you?
Well, classically from my grandparents, it would be country and western, soul, you know, black American soul. It would be reggae, like ska, I guess, early reggae, rock steady, and ska. That was sort of a backdrop. Then the sort of generation below that, it was very much roots reggae. Acid house was sort of like coming in, then hip hop. It was so incredibly diverse. Lovers rock, Rare Groove. You know, there was bits of like Hall & Oates and Talking Heads. It was just the backdrop was music, really.
Yeah. And tell me, you know, as you're starting to kind of leave the house and kind of explore these places, what were your kind of first memories of seeing people express themselves? Because I know you've spoken a lot about your older sister, Michelle, and how she was a really important influence on your life. But I also remember you once telling me about, I think it was your grandfather, who would go home in the mid-afternoon to steam his trousers, to iron the crease back into his trousers.
It was actually my uncle, who had the best name on the planet. His name was Cleophas Erastus Casanova Rose. And he was an amazing, amazing person. But he was absolutely, you know, completely fixated on how he looked, not in a very vain way, he was completely fastidious, you know what I mean? It had to be really perfect. And the press in his trousers was very, very important. You know, it was this sharpness, this attention to detail. He used to go home halfway through the day and repress the thing into his trousers just to get that like iron sharp hold down the centre. But in terms of, I guess my first really outward looking bit was when I was 9 and my nan used to take me to, after church, we used to go to Clapham Common, because all of the kids, including my cousins, used to congregate there after going to Rain Dance or Camden Palais and stuff, which they did on a Saturday night. They often came back on Sunday morning. And because it was in a park, we could go. And it was, again, it was one of those spontaneous things that just happened. It just happened. These kids just started to gather on Clapham Common because they didn't want to be home. They didn't want to go home yet because they were still buzzing from the night before. And they just carried on partying. And it became this informal party on Clapham Common for some, well, I remember it being a long time. It probably wasn't that long before the police shut it down. And kids used to rock up and open their car doors and carry on playing music. And my nan, bless her, in our like sort of church Sunday best, used to come up, put a rug down, and we used to sit down and watch them. And I remember and sort of participate in it. I mean, we were definitely on the outside, but we had this. It was a very early introduction, I guess, into club culture. And it was the first time that I remember seeing all of these people, particularly sort of football hooligans, who a couple of years before we'd been told to cross the road to avoid, because that was football hooliganism. Really, it was one of the references that I use in my collection all the time. And that's why, it was because I remember suddenly seeing this mix of people, like it was sort of ex-football hooligans with rosters, with crusties, with rude boys. And because they had been all partying together the night before, they were just embracing each other and dancing, and they were just engaging. It was the biggest mix of people I think I'd ever seen. And I knew instinctively, even at that young age, that something important was happening. Like, I knew that it was something significant. I knew that a shift had happened.
Yeah.
I sort of understood that. And, you know, I didn't know at the time, but like football hooliganism literally died overnight because basically ecstasy and drug culture and dance culture came in, and they were no longer fighting in the terraces because they had this other outlet. So that was my first real, like, I don't know, like click, like it was a real click.
Yeah, that to me feels like, I grew up in London as well, and I never had that moment where it kind of clicked and it was significant. I just, it was just happening in the background.
But... Yeah, no, exactly. It was a really, I think it was a really unusual situation. And like, I was nine and all of these things were happening in a really informal way and there wasn't any parameters. And I had this early experience of club culture at a really young age. I think that's the only reason that it felt significant. This shift in culture was happening and I could access it at 9 years old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. And fast forward to your 13th birthday. You had your 13th birthday, if I remember correctly, at an illegal venue called Strawberry Sundays.
Yeah, which was in the arch where we had our, or one of the arches where we had our show. Again, like another sort of, there's then been these sort of significant shifts. And once I was nine and I had that, I was just chomping at the bit to just hurry up and get to this point in my life where I could actually go independently. So yeah, I was already sort of like ahead in terms of looking for it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had my 14th birthday inside this place called Strawberry Sundays, which was at the time it didn't have his license and it was started by a homeless guy called Conan, what I remember. And that was, that was like another, like, you know, it didn't disappoint me, this feeling of being in a club for the first time and having all of the sort of freaks and weirdos. And it was like, you know, it was techno, it was hardcore, it was it's always been dance music for me. Once I was choosing my own, all of the music prior to that had been chosen for me. That was just there. That was just sort of like feeding me in a different way, but it wasn't music I was chosen. I was just exposed to that. Once I was making my own choices about music, it was dance music because it was really club culture that was exciting. And obviously that shift had happened. I remember going into Strawberry Sundays and waiting, just hearing the bass on the outside and just being like electrified and just going in. And it was just loads of, it was such a, again, like a crazy mix of people. It was like ravers, but really a mix of ages from what I remember. Obviously I was so young, so everyone seemed old to me and they probably weren't, but like it felt like there were just this sort of like cyber dog, like crazy dressed people. It was like this freedom and this expression that it's just never left me, really.
Yeah, you caught the bug.
I caught the bug.
Tell me about how you were kind of expressing yourself. I mean, you mentioned your choices in music. What were you wearing and where was this interest in clothes starting to form for you personally?
Well, I'd always been interested in clothes, but it wasn't even like how I was dressing myself. It was more, you know, that did sort of come into it as I was getting older, more further into my teenage years. But what ignited my interest in clothes was really watching my cousins and stuff go out and my sister and stuff and how they would dress, because it felt very, you know, it was very sort of distinct, you know, my sister being into like roots reggae and all of that sort of scene and rare groove and all of that. So what they would go to, what she would wear was like lots of JPG, lots of Pam Hogg, Helen Story. She was pretty brave in her fashion choices. She just had very innate good style, you know. I remember recognizing that. And then my cousin was into all of these other, you know, Boy London and, you know, whatever. So that was my first interest. And my granddad was a tailor, and also Jamaican culture, it's inherently there, it's interest, it's sort of preoccupied with style, not fashion, style. And how you put things together, how you sort of add your personality to things. So that was always there, I guess, watching all of these sort of characters coming to my nan's house and all of that. And then when I was going out myself, it was very in line with the music that I was listening to. So, you know, when it was garage, it would be more dressy. When it was like jungle, when it was the raves, it would be, you know, a flyer jacket, world dance and some lycra crop top and, you know, sort of baggy trousers. It really depended. I was a bit, and I stole loads of my sister's clothes. Loads. I mean, when I think about what I stole and lost, I like could kick myself, and I've never had the courage to tell my sister. But I was sort of like nicking like her great JPG bits out of her wardrobe. I was terrible. Lots of Sub Couture, lots of stuff from Kensington Market, lots of stuff from Hyper, Wit and Wisdom. There were so many like small independent brands that sort of sprung up around club culture, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting. Like, all of the names that you've mentioned would form such an interesting archive.
Yeah.
A fashion archive today, like, that has so much subcultural...
Yeah. And subcultural context. Yeah.
Yeah.
It all felt like it was for going out. It felt like it was close to dancing. It was close to show off in. But it didn't feel generic at all. Do you know what I mean? It felt like you could buy the same things, but you know, I don't know, there was a sense of character and style that you could add to it. You know what I mean? It didn't feel like high street nowadays. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's much less uniform in a way.
Less uniform, exactly. It wasn't about what you were spending on it. Everyone at the time got those Versace glasses, a real drum and bass. It was like a drum and bass code or a jungle code, and they were the ones with the big
Medusa heads
on the side. And everyone would be wearing them in a club, like in a club, in sunglasses. But it was like, it was just part of the look. Some high fashion labels trickled down to the dance floor, like Moschino, Iceberg, Versace. But it sort of was nothing to really that much to do with their main line. It was like Versace jeans. And it was like the diffusion lines.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, again, this kind of goes back to this idea of subculture, which I find so interesting and obviously think about a lot today because things are so different now. But it is kind of like these codes, and it's very much like you have to get it, you have to know what that is. And like, you know, if you have the knowledge, you can kind of clock something.
Yeah.
But otherwise you would just think, okay, Versace sunglasses. But actually it tells you about what that person likes in terms of music, where they like to go out, who their crew is, you know?
Exactly. And I think that's always what I've fallen in love with about clothes, really.
Yeah. And tell me a bit about, okay, you're a bit older and you're, you know, kind of later in your teenage years, and you had kind of gone on to study fashion, but how was London changing? Because also I feel like you're kind of, from the age of 9 to now, this great encyclopedia of club culture. What were you starting to notice in new scenes that were coming up that you were interested in, new places that you were going to, maybe when you were a bit older?
So when I was sort of studying, I started working in members bars in Soho. So there was a whole period of my life which was really located in this other sort of crazy life, which was old members bars in Soho. So I worked at Century for a little bit, and then I started working at Blacks. And actually prior to that, I was working in Plastic People.
Yeah,
I started working in Plastic People I was there for like 3 years. I mean, that was just heaven, really. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Because it was like, not only was it my favourite club in London, it was a bit like a youth club where I'd see all of my friends. And it was just the best sort of like youth club, I guess is the best way I can describe it, because it had the best nights, it had the best sound system, it had the most amazing music policy, had the most sort of discerning taste and was really uncompromising and taught me so much about having a vision. Do you know what I mean? Everything was sort of his vision. I mean, he was so sort of clever and ahead of his time. So I mean, that was like an amazing playground in my early 20s. Mm. And this is when sort of breakbeat stuff was happening, I guess. So it was like a co-op, Bugs in the Attic, around 2000. Mm. And then after that, I sort of had this whole period that was in Soho in central London. And that was a very different kind of nightlife. Again, like, I think it sort of reinforced my love of outsiders, you know, outsiders and characters and complicated geniuses. And, you know, I mean, I had the most fun. It was probably the most debauched time. Really, like, my, you know, dancing, you know, my club culture bits, it wasn't that messy because I was just really into dancing. I was really into, I mean, I still am really into the music. Do you know what I mean? That was really transportive for me. And then this period in Soho was like, I mean, I could drink anyone under the table and still cash up. It was crazy. But, you know, I met the most interesting people.
Mm.
Really, it was really a sort of a bohemian period, you know, and these clubs really, again, sort of like uncompromising on who they were serving, uncompromising what the door policy was, and what the membership policy was. And it wasn't based on how much money, it was based on you had to contribute, you know what I mean?
Everyone
had to contribute, you had to bring something, and it wasn't necessarily money, but you couldn't come with nothing. You had to come with something. You know what I mean? And it really, like, I can't tell you from the highest to the lowest, everyone was in those clubs, and the only sort of thread between them was that they were great. And whatever form that came.
Yeah. But there were also so many clubs. Like, I think of Soho at that time, there was just more places to go out in this tiny patch.
Yeah, they used to call it the sort of triangles, the Holy Trinity. So most people would start at the French, you would go on to Colony, you would then go to Black's usually, and then you'd end up at Jerry's. And that was hardcore, you know, you'd sort of like wash up at Jerry's. And then like everything in between, I mean, there were so many little clubs and thingies. And then we would often go to La Caponina, which was a strip club. And because that was open, I think it was open until the last person standing, basically. And it basically catered for cab drivers and misfits. Yeah. And the girls in there, you know, they'd come up to you for a dance. You'd go, I'm just here for a drink, actually. And they go, oh, right, fine, no problem. Delighted. You know what I mean? They didn't have to do a strip. But it was funny. It was really run down. I don't even know if it's still there. I think it was the oldest one. So it was like, I don't know, my love of London is deep, and based on all of those experiences, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Speaking of kind of nightlife and all of these venues and how much London has changed.
Yeah.
If you were to bring back any venue that has since closed in London, which one would it be?
I don't know. There's so many, man. We have lost. I was reading the depressing article the other day that we have lost a third of clubs and, like, you know, bars, and how to, as an upcoming musician, when you're sort of like learning your trade and stuff, where do you go? You go, of course, you sell out arenas and stuff like that, but where do you learn it? Where do you have that intimacy? Well, where do you have those moments? DJs, where do you sort of practice and stuff? There were so many. And also, funny enough, when I was looking, because I was looking to see if the arch that we did the show in, in Vauxhall, I was like, was this the Strawberry Sundays arch? I couldn't quite remember what arch it was. So I was trying to remember, and I was Googling, I was looking back, and I found this old Evening Standard club listing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, holy shit. Because you lose things and you forget, right? You forget what you've lost. You just move, you're just getting on with what you've got on with. But it was like Monday night, you know, Bar Rumba, Coliseum, you know, the ends, like every single night of the week, there were five or six clubs that you could go to, and you could keep going through. We were so spoiled. You know what I mean? And big and small and different vibes, and ones where you just go in your pajamas and just go, or ones that you really had to, like, there was a real, you know, strict door policy and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just endless. And, you know, seeing it written down, it was just like a normal week, but it was like every single night of the week, there was something going on, loads going on.
Yeah. And also just like how specific it is, because I think, you know, speaking about subculture, it is this kind of power of the niche, I guess, of people finding their tribe. But again, like, I remember growing up, my sister would get Time Out, and I remember sitting there flicking through it when it had, you know, like a Black lesbian kind of jazz night, and you would kind of be flicking through it, and it would be pages after pages of just... things to go out and do. And I just remember, I was far too young to be going out. Like, I definitely wasn't going out at 13. But I remember kind of sitting there and being like, wow, I can't wait to, like, go to this place.
Yeah, but that's what it is. It felt like an adventure. It felt like a playground. To really test it out and figure it out. And there was really nothing stopping you from, you know, going to a Black lesbian, you know, jazz club on Tuesday night. Why wouldn't you?
What else do you have to do, you know?
No, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about your work, because after graduating, you started Align, and then eventually you started the label, let's say, Martine Rose, that the whole world knows today. And I feel like one of the things that I really love about your work and the way that you've done your shows and just over the years, is it feels like London is the star of your brand, and it's kind of the people of London and the people that you see in London walking down the street are very much the star of it. And I can't explain it. It just feels so quintessentially London to me.
Like
it couldn't exist anywhere else in the world, which is funny because you've shown in Paris and you've done other things.
Yeah.
But tell me a bit about kind of creating this brand and what kind of drives you in your work?
People.
Yeah.
It always has been. Clothing is all about people, isn't it? Really. Mm. It's a sort of a celebration of people, but it wasn't a plan. You know, I didn't have a plan. I guess the benefit of starting a label when I started it is that there wasn't any social media or stuff like that. So I had an opportunity to figure out who I was,
yeah,
without anyone watching, really.
Mm.
You know, it's really hard. Obviously, it's hard when you're having to work, you know, three jobs to keep this very expensive hobby going. Yeah. But what it did give me was an opportunity to, like, make mistakes and to really figure out who I was. I didn't have the confidence to apply for jobs, really. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't put on a CV what, like, my discernible skills. I'm always amazed when interns have, or, you know, graduates have that unbelievable sort of focus, and they're like, right, I'm going to, you know, a house in Paris or something. I never had that sort of confidence. And it's not really that I'm an unconfident person in myself, but I didn't know what I could put on a CV. So the easiest thing for me to do was to set up a label and figure out what can I do, you know, what is it? And it took me a while. It wasn't like, right, it's all going to be about, you know, celebrating London. It's all going to be about this. That it's happened over time as I've become more confident, I guess. I'm like, actually, this is also fashion. I can do it my way and it's still valid. But that takes a really long time to get to that level for me anyway, it's taken a long time to get to that sort of confidence to say,
yeah,
actually, this is what I feel like expressing and this is what I feel like is cool for me.
Yeah, that conviction, you know, conviction in yourself. Yeah. Was there a moment that kind of changed for you? Because also I think that fashion... I went to fashion school and fashion has changed so much over the last however many years. But, you know, I think that, like, even when I was at fashion school, there was occasionally very narrow ideas of what fashion could be.
Yeah.
So if you kind of had something outside of that, like, you were met with a, you know, this isn't quite right, this isn't going to fly, this is not how the kind of images that you see in magazines or the kind of clothes you see on Bond Street. Did you experience that?
Yeah, oh my, hugely. I found Paris completely intimidating, unwelcoming in lots of ways.
Mm.
Wasn't really anything that I connect to, and I found it wasn't what really sparked my love of clothes. And that's not to say, like, my God, you know, living at when I graduated, there was McQueen, Marc Jacobs, Galliano. Of course, I was looking at those things, and that didn't feel like me, but it felt electrifying. I was excited by it.
Mm.
It still felt an alien world to me, and I still found it really intimidating. And yeah, I mean, that was really the motivation to start my own thing, was a sort of a lack of confidence rather than the opposite.
So when did that change for you? Like, was there a moment that kind of shifted within yourself?
I've always been really lucky, and it's been a double-edged sword. I've always had just enough people going, it's good, it's good. And, you know, people of some standing in the industry. So it was just enough to keep going. Certainly wasn't enough to make a career, but that was enough to sort of, like, keep it bubbling over. And I was perfectly happy working in bars and clubs.
Mm.
I was sort of happy doing it as a sideline. I was always a bit ambivalent about fashion for a really long time. Later, I realized that working in clubs and bars was actually feeding the fashion work, but I hadn't put it all together. So I always had enough sort of support in the industry.
Yeah.
You know, Mandy Leonard, Lulu, Kim Jones, you know, and there have been various people that have sort of, like, dropped in and just going little sort of champions.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really until I started working with Demna that it was like this sort of much bigger shift that made me feel like a fully fledged designer.
Yeah. So just for context, this is in, I think, 2017, is it? You started...
2016.
2016, you started working with Demna at Balenciaga as a design consultant.
Yeah.
And I remember reading, actually, and I found this so interesting. I think, were you pregnant at the time? Or you had just had a baby?
I just had Valentine. Yeah, she was three months old. My God, it couldn't have come at a better time, really. I'd had Valentine and I thought, right, shit, I can't keep, teaching and working in clubs and all of that stuff and having a baby and doing this collection. Something's got to give, and it's going to be, obviously, it's going to be the label.
Yeah. Because I remember you kind of saying in an interview that your own housing situation was really complicated. I think you had been evicted and put in temporary housing, and then this kind of like job came along and it was like a saving grace.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Mm. Yeah. I have told Demna, consequently. I have, you have no idea. That couldn't have come at a better time.
Yeah.
You know, but it was terrifying as well at the same time. Oh, actually, do you know what? Funny enough, I had a big clear out at my house the other day and I came across a diary. And the diary, it must have been because I was so overwhelmed. I just had Valentine. It was written 6 months, so 3 months before I started at Balenciaga and sort of 3 months into it. And I was writing down everything and I read it and it took me, because you remember it, but you don't remember it. You know what I mean? You remember the period, but you don't remember the detail. But in the diary, I'd written loads of detail and it took me straight back there. It was like, phew.
Yeah.
And I was like, shit, I remember that feeling. It was like, you know, huge self-doubt. Can I even do this? I'm imposter syndrome beyond.
Mm.
But Demna was so sort of kind and we really got on. We really, really got on fundamentally. It was that. We had lots and lots of similar references and we laughed a lot. Mm. It's a lot of that. It was a lot of laughing and a lot of sort of like funny. And we just sort of connected and he helped me through. I didn't feel judged. You know what I mean? He really sort of like coached me through it in a way.
Yeah.
He was just like, well, I believe in you. Who gives a shit about anything else?
Mm. What is interesting is that around this time, I think even your work for your own label became so much more confident. And I think about kind of your shows during London Fashion Week, you started doing them in kind of just really off-piece venues in the context of London Fashion Week,
which is
usually kind of very grand venues or in the centre of the city.
Yeah.
But, you know, you did one at a climbing centre in Tottenham, a cul-de-sac in Kentish Town, the market in Seven Sisters. And it was kind of all of these places that if you live in London, you know, and we all live in these places, you know, many people who live right bang in the centre of London.
No, exactly.
But it felt like a celebration again of the unexpected, of the reality of London and the kind of everyday heroes that are part of these communities.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was building this confidence up.
Mm.
You know what I mean? I was starting to believe that actually maybe my view on fashion is relevant. You know what I mean? Mm. And maybe there is another way and maybe people will come to Tottenham to a Colombian market to sort of like watch this funny extravaganza. But, you know, like I said, I set up the label in 2007. Mm. You know what I mean? That was quite a long time after. Yeah. It takes time to build.
Yeah.
You know, to build the confidence in your language.
Yeah.
Well, it certainly took me time.
What advice do you have for, say, a young designer who is living and working in London today and really struggling, as so many are, with the costs and the challenges of being a creative here? But what advice do you have for someone that is thinking of throwing in the towel and giving up? And
man, it's so hard, isn't it? I mean, I have the benefit of having my family living in London. So I always had that as a sort of safety net. I would say the industry isn't really set up to take notice of real grassroots stuff, right? That's sort of down to you. What I would say is that no one is an island. You don't do it on your own. And even me saying that now really confidently, it's my name on everything.
Mm.
I am so far from on my own. Do you know what I mean? Mm. I have an army of people helping me do everything. But it's an army that I found really, really young.
Mm.
And I would say, take notice of the people around you. Take notice of the people at the same stage as you. Mm. Find people that that you align with, you know what I mean? Across the board, art directors, graphic designers, stylists, you know what I mean? Producers, whoever, find those musicians, find those people and stick with them. You know what I mean? Find it and do it together because you're stronger together and you will do it together. You know what I mean? And it takes time.
And now, of course, you have such a broad audience around the world. And it's funny, to go back to the start of the conversation, like, I think your work of being this kind of glossary of British subcultural references, whether it's Acid Househeads or The Junglists or Rude Boys, you know, whatever it is. And it's kind of like all of these codes of British subculture.
Yeah.
But where today are you looking to for kind of inspiration, or what's interesting you? What scenes are interesting you right now? And where are you going out and looking around and people watching?
Oh, God. I mean, obviously I can't, I have two children now. It's been proper for me to bear going out the way that I used to go out. But honestly, the feeling of going out, the feeling that I get on a dance floor hasn't changed. It's something that's never left me, when that you get that magic combination of music, venue, crowd. It's completely electrifying, and I still feel like 14-year-old standing outside of, you know, Strawberry Sundays. It genuinely feels like that. But you know, I get loads of inspiration from it. Like I said, it's above all else, my inspiration is rooted in people. I can get just as excited at seeing someone dressed incredibly well, which you actually see quite a lot in Finsbury Park, as I can someone dressed really well in a club. Do you know what I mean? Someone at a bus, someone that's just taken that care to either sort of that care in the detail, you know, the brooch, the this, the that, or like a foot. Like my friend had texted me and he was just like, look at this guy on the tube with this evolved style. And he sent me this picture, and it was this old man, and he was sitting on a normal carriage. Everyone was very boring, puffer jackets, all black, navy blue, whatever. And he was wearing a zigzag shoe, a stripy sock, like a check trouser and a polka dot hat, which sounds insane. You would think that it sounds like a clown.
Yeah.
Looked so incredibly dapper. It's such a very specific choice of everything, and that it's just, you know what I mean, it's just so uplifting. It's wonderful.
I will never forget being at a bus stop, one of the biggest compliments I've ever gotten in my life.
Yeah.
I was at a bus stop in Stoke Newington, and I was wearing this suit.
Yeah.
And it was from a vintage shop. I don't even think I still have it. And a Jamaican man went past me and he stopped and he said, man, you got style and it ain't easy.
Oh.
And I just thought, oh my God. And those words stuck with me. And I just, and then he walked away and I was like,
that's enough.
Yeah. 15 years later, I'm still thinking about it. And my next two questions are really, because when I told some of the boys on the team that I was speaking to you, they were like, oh my God, you have to ask her about football. So football, have you always been a fan? Are you a fan? And what team do you support? You're not.
No, but this is the misconception about me and football. I'm not really a fan. I'm like, not a fan. I'm like, whatever about the game.
Yeah.
But I'm preoccupied with the culture.
Yes.
I find the culture around football absolutely fascinating. And like what I was saying earlier about this sort of like shift in culture when ecstasy became a thing and suddenly football hooliganism died overnight. And I find the sort of like the pleasure and the pain that it can provoke in a nation. I find it, you know, sort of unifying and stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, obviously there are games that I watch, but I'm not sort of like avid. I mean, my partner is obsessed with West Ham. So I'm by default, I'm a West Ham supporter. But it's not the actual game itself. It's sort of the power that it has to unite and divide.
Mm-hmm. Mm. If you weren't a fashion designer, what would you be?
Oh, shit. If I wasn't a fashion designer, what would I be? Oh, I'd be a barmaid. I'm serious. I miss
work. Okay, but the question is where would you be a barmaid?
Oh, that is a good question. I mean, if the Blacks that I worked in still existed, I would probably be Blacks, Colony. I'd be in Soho.
Okay. Thank you so much. I've loved speaking to you. I mean, it's always a pleasure, but thank you so, so, so much for being a part of this.
Thanks for having me.
This episode of Identity was presented by me, Osman Ahmed, with research by Ailey Duffy and art direction by Callum Glenday. The producer was Amelia Phillips, with audio production from Robin Lieberman and Simon Williams. Identity is a Podmasters production for ID Magazine.